The line of flags led them in a wide circle to the north along the edge of a deep chasm with sheer sides, and on up a series of natural terraces where the bare earth was a soft peachy colour that belied its harsh and barren nature. The step of the third and final terraces was lined with over 50 of the more hardy spectators who had climbed up from Galala. As Nefer's chariot raced up towards them, they cheered them onwards and opened their ranks to let them through. The summit of the terrace was flat and level. In the centre of this open space, the wrestlers waited. Each stood in his own circle of white-painted stones. Nefer steered down towards them, with the crowd running after them, cheering and laughing with excitement. Just short of the stone rings, Nefer brought the horses to a halt, and two grooms who were standing ready ran forward to take their heads. "See, they drink only one bucket each," Nefer ordered as he jumped down. This was the first point at which they were permitted to water the horses, but Nefer did not want their bellies blown up with liquid. Swiftly, Nefer and Merin stripped off their leather armour and the short chitons beneath until they stood stark naked in the sunlight. The crowd hummed with admiration when their young, hard bodies, trained to athletic perfection, were revealed, and some of the women of low status and dubious morality ululated and cavorted lewdly with excitement. Now, every second that passed brought the pursuing chariots closer. Nefer did not even glance at the dancing women, but he and Merin strode forward, each towards the ring where his allotted opponent waited. Nefer paused outside the ring of white stones and looked at Polios of Ur, who stood in the centre. He was not exceptionally big or tall, nor larger or heavier than Nefer, for the judges had matched them carefully and fairly. However, there was no fat or superfluous flesh on Polios. It was obvious that he'd been limbering up, for he shone with sweat and oil, and his muscles were engorged and flushed with blood. Everything about him was hard. His shoulders were in perfect proportion to his waist, his belly flat, his limbs long and supple. He stood with his arms folded over his chest and watched Nefer with a hard, flat stare. Nefer took one long breath and heard again Taita's words in his ear, as clearly as if he'd spoken again in his ear. "The left knee, that is his only weakness." He dropped his eyes to the limb, but Polios's left knee seemed as sturdy as the right, hard and impregnable as the main stem of an olive tree. Nefer touched the golden charm at his throat and stepped into the ring of stones. The crowd howled and yelped and shouted. Polios placed his hands on his knees and hunched his shoulders and watched him with the flat, implacable stare of a serpent. Nefer knew that he must make the first advance, for Polios was in no hurry. His task was to delay Nefer here until the pursuing chariots could catch up with him. Nefer circled him once, and Polios turned slowly to keep facing him. Yes, Nefer told himself, there it is. He drags his left toe. But it was so tiny a flaw he would never have picked it out without Taita's advice. "An old injury," Taita had told him. "Here." And he'd pressed his thumb into Nefer's knee to mark the exact site of it. But then Taita had gone on, "Even so, do not rate him lightly. He is a man-killer. This is his favourite throw, and it's well-nigh irresistible." Taita had demonstrated it. Nefer circled back the other way, and Polios turned with him. He saw it now, a faint unnatural hollow below the bulge of the kneecap. He could not afford another moment, and he closed. Each of them fell into the classical prelude, grabbing at each other with both hands, seeking the throwing grip, changing the holds, shifting weight, pushing and then giving, feeling the other man's balance. Then suddenly Polios leapt forward, coming in low under Nefer's guard, and though Nefer had been expecting it, he could not prevent one long arm whipping round his waist. Suddenly he was lifted high, so only the tips of his toes touched the earth, and Polios spun with him in his arms, turning him backward so that he could not keep his balance. Then suddenly Polios dropped on his right knee and brought Nefer down with him. His other leg was braced solid, left thigh parallel to the ground like a carpenter's bench. Nefer came down across it, and it caught him in the small of his back at the level of his kidneys. It should have snapped his spine, but Nefer had practiced the counter 100 times with Merin. He arched his back to take the strain and at the same time slammed both his heels into the ground to break the force of it. Even so, he felt his spine creak as his vertebrae were strained to the very limit. Polios came down on him with the full weight of his upper torso, but Nefer reached under his back and clamped his right hand on Polios's knee. Taita had made him spend hours hardening his right thumb, squeezing a ball of leather until he could leave a deep indentation in the surface. Even then Taita had not been satisfied. He had made Nefer continue these exercises until he could crack a cowrie shell between thumb and forefinger. Then time and again Taita demonstrated the exact point under the kneecap where the injury lay, and the direction of pressure he must apply to sunder it. Nefer found it now, and drove his thumb into the hollow between the head of the tibia and the unattached kneecap. Every muscle in Nefer's right arm stood out with the effort, and his eyes seemed to bulge from their sockets. Then suddenly he felt something give under the point of his thumb, and he made one final effort. His thumb went in deeper, the weakened cartilage and sinew cracking and popping as they tore. The kneecap lifted in Nefer's grip, ripped from its seat. Polios screamed, a sound of such extreme agony that it hushed the roar of the spectators that crowded the edge of the ring. Polios released his own hold and tried to push Nefer away from him, but Nefer rolled easily with the throw, never releasing his grip on the mangled kneecap, tearing it further open. Suddenly, rendered helpless as an infant, Polios sobbed and choked on the pain of it. Nefer came up on top of him and forced his face into the earth. He twisted his left leg up behind him, and Polios could not resist. Nefer bent the shattered knee back until the heel touched Polios's buttocks and put all his weight upon it. The terrible cry that Polios gave out sounded not human. "Yield!" Nefer commanded, but Polios was dumb and paralyzed with agony. The umpire ran forward to touch Nefer's shoulder and signal his victory. Nefer sprang to his feet and left Polios writhing and blubbering in the dirt. The spectators parted silently in front of him, stunned by the swiftness and completeness of his victory. Nefer heard someone in the crowd say, "He'll never walk on that leg again." But he never looked back as he ran to the other ring and pushed out of his way the men that surrounded it. Merin and Sigasa the crocodile were locked chest to chest. They rolled across the ring, first one on top, then the other. Nefer saw at a glance that Merin was injured. Sigasa's diseased skin was thick and horny, impervious to pain, and he used it now like a weapon, rubbing himself against him, tearing Merin's flesh so the blood oozed up from the shallow lacerations across his chest and arms. Taita had warned them of that, but it was impossible to avoid his loathsome embrace, and Merin was being overpowered. Nefer had arrived only just in time. The rules of the Red Road were deliberately stacked against the novices. However, they allowed one novice to come to the aid of the other, but only after he had defeated his own opponent. This was one of the few concessions they were granted. Nefer took full advantage of it. The moment he was into the ring, Nefer stooped and picked up a white pebble the size and shape of a dove's egg. As he ran to Merin's aid, he placed the stone in the centre of his palm, wrapped his fingers and thumb round it, and clasped it so firmly that his knuckles whitened under the pressure. He turned his fist into a weapon as effective as a carpenter's mallet. The crowd shouted a warning to the crocodile, and he released Merin and came to his feet in one swift movement. Head down, he charged at Nefer. Taita had warned him that his bald and knobbly skull was a deadly battering ram. Sigasa had already cracked two of Merin's ribs with his first charge, and now he strove to do the same with Nefer. Nefer let him come on, judging his moment, placing his feet firmly. And then he swung his clenched right fist into the side of Sigasa's jaw at the precise point that Taita had shown him. The weight and speed of Sigasa's own rush met the full power of Nefer's shoulders behind the blow. The great scaly head snapped back and Sigasa's legs turned soft as porridge under him. But his momentum carried him on. He sprawled full length over the line of marker stones. No one in the crowd had ever seen a bare fist used as a weapon. They gaped in amazement. Even Nefer was startled by the result, for Sigasa lay without twitching. Nefer recovered in a moment and yelled at the umpire, "Sigasa has left the ring. He must forfeit." The umpire shouted his agreement. "Nefer City is the victor. Sigasa forfeits the bout. You are through and clear, Nefer City." Nefer ran to Merin and hauled him to his feet. "Are you hurt?" "My ribs. The swine butted like a bull," he gasped. "We must go on." "Of course." Merin straightened and squared his shoulders. His face was grey as ashes with the pain.
It's nothing.
But he clutched the side of his chest as they ran back to the chariot. Hastily they pulled on their discarded chitons and strapped on the leather armour.
That took too long. We're losing ground every second.
As they scrambled up on the footplate of the chariot, they both looked back down the terraced slope of the hills towards the javelin butts on the plain below.
There they are,
Meron grunted, and they saw the dust cloud boiling up and ethereal in the sunlight. The pursuing vehicles were still only dark specks beneath the hovering dust, but they seemed to grow in size even as they watched them. There was nothing to say. The pursuers would not be tested by the wrestlers. They would ride straight past the rings of stone. Nefer and Meron knew how meagre was their lead, and how swiftly they could lose even that small advantage. It needed only one more wrong step or miscalculation on their part. Nefer shook out the reins and called to the team. Dov and Krus had rested while they'd been wrestling. Now they were refreshed. They lent their full weight into the harness and sped away. Ahead, the line of flags marking the course began the wide turn back into the south, in the direction from which they'd come.
Halfway through,
Meron tried to sound gay, but his voice was tight with the pain of his cracked ribs, and each breath he drew was agony. They crossed the plateau and reached the far side, where the terraces dropped in a series of giant steps to the rim of the chasm. They looked down towards the paddocks and pastures of the irrigated lands, startlingly green against the ochre and dun hues of the surrounding landscape, and the towers and rooftops of Galala, so tumbled and earth-coloured, that from this distance they seemed not man-made, but natural features of the desert. They looked ahead, and the chasm gaped at them like the maw of a monster. Its sides were sheer and unscalable, falling to shaded purple depths. There were small groups of people on the path that skirted the top of the cliffs. These were the spectators who had watched the trial of the javelins, and who had taken the short cut and were hurrying to watch the archery trial. Nefer drove hard down the entrance, pushing the horses to their best speed, trying to win back even a few yards from the pursuit. This was where Krus made up in full measure for his mistakes at the javelin butts. His great strength bore them on and gave new heart to Dov at his side. They reached the lip of the chasm and raced along the edge, so close to it that the small pebbles thrown up by the wheels were flung out over the void. Though Krus was on the side closest to it, he never broke his stride but leant into the tracers and ran with all his heart and will. Nefer felt his spirits soar on high.
"We can still beat them to the bridge,"
he shouted in the wind.
"Come away, Krus! Come away, Dov!"
Nefer looked ahead and saw the tall, unmistakable figure of Taita standing on the lip of the precipice. He was staring across the chasm at the archery targets on the far side, and he did not look round as they pulled up behind him and jumped down from the chariot. The previous evening, Taita had predicted, "With the west wind blowing, the archery and the crossing of the chasm will determine the final outcome. I will wait for you there." They took down the bows and arrow quivers from the racks and left the horses in the care of the waiting grooms as they hurried to join Taita at the edge of the cliff.
"We lost time at the javelin butts,"
Nefer told him grimly as he strung the great war bow, one end anchored on the ground between his feet as he exerted all his strength and weight on the other end to flex the stock.
"Krus was too eager," Taita said, "and so were you. But there's no profit in looking back. Look ahead."
He pointed across the deep void to where the targets were suspended on a light bamboo scaffolding. As at the javelin butts, there were five targets. They were inflated pig's bladders, each suspended on the cross piece of the scaffold by a length of flax twine. They were well separated, so that an arrow intended for one would not strike another by chance. The twine that held them was 2 cubits long, so they had freedom of movement. Light as air, they danced on the west wind, bobbing and ducking unpredictably. The great open void between them made it almost impossible to judge the range accurately, and the west wind swirled and eddied along the cliffs. The force and direction of the wind that they felt on this side of the chasm would be different from that on the far bank. However, it would affect the arrows almost as much as the targets.
"What's the range, old father?"
Nefer asked as he chose a long arrow from the quiver. Earlier that morning, Taita had paced out one side of a right-angled triangle along the lip of the chasm. Then he'd gauged the angle subtended by the targets on the far side with a weird arrangement of pegs and strings on a board. He'd used these measurements, in a manner that was unfathomable to Nefer, to calculate the range across the chasm. 127 cubits, Taita told him now. Nefer added this information to his own calculations of wind speed and direction as he took his stance on the crumbling edge of the cliff. Meron stepped up beside him with the lighter cavalry bow in his hand.
In the name of Horus and the goddess, Nefer prayed, let us begin.
They shot at the same time. Nefer's arrow dropped over the crosspiece of the scaffold, too long and high. Meron's arrow rose at a steeper angle, aimed wide into the wind. As it slowed to the top of its trajectory, the wind took hold of it, and it veered to the left, almost at the limit of its range. It dropped towards the dangling, bobbing line of pig splatters. It struck the middle target cleanly, and they heard the pop as it burst and disappeared like a stroke of magic. A joyous shout went up from the watchers, and the umpire called the hit in a loud voice. But Meron muttered as he knocked another arrow,
that was a fluke. I'll take any more flukes like that you have in your quiver, Nefer told him. Buck here, brother. Buck here.
They drew and fired again. This time Meron's arrow fell short, rattling against the rocks of the cliff. Nefer missed the bladder on the right-hand end by half a cubit and cursed Seth for the wind that he had sent. Unlike the javelins, the rules of the Red Road placed no limit on the number of arrows they were allowed. The only stipulation was that they must carry them all in the chariot from the start. So it was a trade-off between weight and numbers. They'd each brought 50 missiles, but one of Nefer's long arrows weighed half as much again as one of Meryn's. They shot and missed, and shot again and missed again. Taita had watched the wind and the flight of each arrow. He'd gathered all his powers around him to feel the strength and impetus of that treacherous wind. He could almost see it, the flow and the strength of it, like the currents in a clear stream of water.
"Hold the same point of aim," he ordered Nefer, "but wait for my command."
Nefer drew to full strength, and though every muscle in his right arm quivered with the strain, he held it. Taita read the wind, became part of it, felt it in the depths of his being. "Now!" he whispered, and the arrow leapt out high over the void and wavered on the capricious airs. Then, like a towering falcon, it seemed to gather itself and stoop to the target. The bladder popped as it struck, and the crowd howled.
"The next one," Taita ordered, and Nefer drew, held his aim high, and to the right of the second bladder. "Now," Taita whispered.
The old man seemed to control the flight of the arrow by the force of his mind. At the very last instant before it struck, the west wind tried spitefully to turn it aside, but it held the line, and the bladder burst with a sharp crack.
"The next one, draw," whispered Taita. "Hold!"
And a heartbeat later,
"Now!"
This time the arrow almost touched the bladder, but at the last moment the ball bounced aside. Nefer shot again on Taita's command, and he missed by a full arrow length high and left. The strain of working the great bow was too much. His right arm ached and his muscles cramped and jumped involuntarily.
"Rest," Taita ordered. "Take the periapt of Lostris in your right hand and rest."
Nefer laid aside the bow and stood with his head bowed in an attitude of prayer, with a golden amulet in his right hand. He felt the strength begin to flow back into his bow arm. Meron was still trying with a smaller bow, but the pain of his cracked ribs almost doubled him over and the sweat of agony ran down his pale face. At that moment, the crowd along the top of the cliff stirred and turned and looked back up the terrace. Someone shouted,
"They come!"
And the cry was taken up until the shouting was deafening. Nefer lifted his head and saw the first chariot come whirling over the skyline. It was close enough for him to recognize Damios at the reins, his golden hair streaming back on the wind. Behind him came the other chariots of the pursuers, strung out in a line. Faintly he heard the drivers shouting to the horses and the rumble of the wheels over the rough ground.
"Do not look at them,"
Taita ordered him.
Do not think about them. Think only of the target.
Never turned his back on the approaching line of vehicles and lifted the bow.
Draw and hold,
Taita said. The wind spurted and dropped.
Now!
The arrow sped unerringly across the chasm and the fourth bladder burst. Never slid another arrow from the quiver. Then he paused with the shaft in his hand and felt despair in his heart. A dust devil came down, spinning out of the desert, onto the line of targets. The dun-coloured curtains of dust and sand and debris obscured the range, and the single remaining bladder disappeared in his depths. High on the hill behind them, the pursuing charioteers shouted with triumph, and never heard Demios's voice above the roar of the whirlwind.
"Now you must stand and fight me, Nefertiti!
One more target before you're clear!"
Soko, the umpire, shouted sternly.
"Stand your ground!"
"There's no target,"
Nefer protested.
"The will of the nameless god,"
Soko told him.
"You must submit to it."
"There,"
shouted Taita.
"There is the manifest will of a greater and more powerful goddess."
He pointed across the deep ravine at the impenetrable cloud of yellow dust. Like a cork floating up from the depths of a turbid lake, the bladder, with its broken string trailing under it, rose to the top of the dust cloud and skittered in the heated air.
"Now, in the name of the goddess Lostris," Taita urged Nefer, "she is the only one who can help you now." "In the name of the goddess,"
Nefer shouted, threw up the great bow and shot at the tiny balloon in the wild embrace of the storm. Up and up climbed the arrow, and it seemed that it must miss to the left. But abruptly the bladder ducked and dived to meet it. A razor-sharp flint arrowhead slashed it open. It burst and whipped away like a rag on the wind.
"You are through and clear!"
Soko released them with a shout. Nefer dropped the bow and ran to the chariot. Meron ran after him, favouring his injured ribs, and the crowd urged them on as Dov and Krus jumped away together. Behind them the cries of the pursuit were frustrated and angry, but Nefer did not look back. 1,000 paces ahead, the suspension bridge spanned the gorge from cliff to cliff with a terrible drop below. But before they reached it, they must run the fire.